In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by UiPath. Human achievement can be slow. 200,000 years to go from the wheel to your jalopy? Really? But today, 90% of the Fortune 500 are accelerating human achievement simply. When AI is everywhere, every process can be automated and accelerated. 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 UiPath, the AI everywhere foundation of innovation.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Sweet Tarts dared to combine sweet and tart. But we didn't stop there. We combined soft and bouncy to bring you new Sweet Tarts Gummies Fruity Splits, a uniquely delicious dual-sided gummy with one side that's sweet and one side that's tart, but entirely smooth and squishy. Mmm, a powerfully perfect combo. Sweet Tarts, dare to combine.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. From Tudor slop buckets to World War II potato peel recipes, our ancestors had all manner of ingenious methods for using up leftovers. Some of them appetizing, some not so much. And when food waste is presenting a huge issue to tackle in the climate crisis today, can we take any lessons from the past on ways to avoid it? Well, this is a subject that Eleanor Barnett explores in her book, Leftovers, A History of Food Waste and Preservation. And I spoke to her to find out more. Eleanor, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about your book, Leftovers, A History of Food Waste and Preservation. So food waste, I mean, it's definitely a big area of debate in my house, who left those manky carrots to go off in the fridge. But why is it so interesting to look at the broader, bigger history of the subject of food waste?
It's such a topical issue today in everyone's household, but of course in the news as well. You're probably aware of that shocking statistic that a third of the food we produce globally goes to waste. And if all this needlessly discarded food were a country, it would be the third biggest emitter of greenhouse gases. And it's getting more critical as well, right? The UN has this big goal of halving food waste globally by 2030. So I was quite shocked, really, being a historian of food, that no one's really looked at the history of food waste. But it's one way of explaining kind of how we got to this position. Why is it such a big environmental issue today? And how have people in the past managed food waste? Can we learn from them or not?
I mean, absolutely. There are definitely some tips and tricks that we might want to take, but maybe some others that we might want to leave in the past. You say that wasting food has long been a morally charged issue. How so?
I suppose today, right, in the modern era, like I say, we think of it as this environmental issue. We're producing all this food, all the energy, the water, the land that goes into producing it. But then also when it's actually wasted, it just sits there and it emits greenhouse gases. So that is moral in itself, right? But the other thing that it's doing is showing the divide between the rich and poor. So today, you know, there are 842 million people in food insecurity across the world. And food that we waste, which equates to, in the UK at least, £500 a year on average in UK households, could go to feeding these people. And that's been the case throughout history. So if we look at the Tudor era, you know, you have King Henry VIII. I mean, what do you think of when you think of King Henry VIII? Me, at least, I think of this rather large, wealthy man sitting at a big feast, you know, with boar's heads and these sugar sculptures that look like dungeons and just countless courses, right? So there was inevitably food surplus, food waste in these situations. But then you had people in the Tudor era who were, you know, literally starving. You know, the poor were rioting because they couldn't get enough to eat. The price of grain was increasing. Landlords were enclosing fields and stopping people from growing their livestock and therefore being able to feed themselves. So it's incredibly morally charged throughout history. And of course, then it was more often seen in a religious light as well, which is, of course, linked to morality.
Yeah, the Tudor era is really interesting. This is where you begin the book. As you say, we have this massive divide between those enjoying the plenty and those who are kind of reliant on subsistence and harvest to survive. Can you tell us about some of the systems, if that's the right word, or mechanisms that were in place to help prevent food waste?
Yeah, so in grand household, like the palaces, it was common from the Middle Ages, you would have an almoner who would collect the first cuts of meat from the table, and that would be distributed to the poor who kind of waited hungrily at the gates. And in King Henry VIII's household, there's a order that comes in that means everyone in court has to send their scraps, their leftovers, to the almoner, who has two big bowls, pots, one for liquids and one for food scraps.
And would all the food, everything you've got, you know, like sweet food, savoury food, all be put in one pot there?
Yeah, and then it would be up to the almoner to then go and distribute that to people waiting for it. So there were kind of mechanisms to take the edge off that excessive consumption, I suppose. And I think religion really was a way of thinking that people lived by when they're thinking about food waste. So ordinary people as well would have been preached to make sure that they didn't waste their food. You have things like the feeding of the 5,000, the miracle of the fish and the loaves, five loaves and five fish, which gets turned into this massive feast. And there are leftovers. And Jesus says something like, gather up the leftovers so nothing is wasted. So that was taught to people. People were taught about Dives and Lazarus as well in the biblical story, when the rich man, again, is having this amazing feast. And there's a poor man who's waiting for the kind of crumbs from the table, and he's denied. And in the story, ultimately, the poor man goes to heaven, the rich man goes to hell. So people were taught and encouraged from the pulpit not to waste their food. Even people who had less would have been, with that kind of religious motivation, taught to give what they did have to poor neighbours. So things like leftover whey, which is like a liquid you get in cheese making, that would have been distributed to poor people working in the fields, and they could kind of ferment it, and it became a drink for them, basically. Yeah, so that was one way. And then practically, a huge way of preventing food waste was preservation. And I think we don't really think about that so much today, because we're so used to just bunging it in the fridge or the freezer, right? But that's really a modern thing. Then it was, you use sugar or salt, vinegars or fermentation to preserve your food. You'd have in the rich households, it was a delicate art of preserving. You'd have the gentlewomen would have spent long hours in a still room, which is a specific room with the special equipment where they could preserve the harvest of fruit with sugar, and they'd make marmalades and jellies and that kind of thing. And then for ordinary poorer people, they would have lived off salted fish for the whole Lenten fast, which is obviously a long chunk of the year. And again, we just don't think about that, do we?
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Looking to invest? Start your journey by exploring exchange-traded funds with GlobalX ETFs. Exchange-traded funds, or ETFs for short, create baskets of stocks, bonds, and other assets that you can buy in a single trade. GlobalX specializes in ETFs that track emerging trends, like the rise of artificial intelligence, as well as strategies aimed to generate income potential. Visit GlobalXETFs.com to discover how you can get started.
The holidays have arrived early with Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale. Upgrading window coverings can be a minor project with a major impact. Blinds.com makes it easy and affordable. Browse premium blinds, shades, shutters. We have your patio covered too. And get unlimited window treatments installed for one low cost. Free shipping and Blinds.com's 100% satisfaction guarantee. Shop Blinds.com's Spring Black Friday sale now. Save up to 45% plus premium doorbusters. Up to 45% off at Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.
I was going to say, when you've been looking back at all these kind of old recipes for preserving things, are there any that you think are worthy of bringing back today? Any that you've tried yourself, perhaps, or any as well that, you know, you think are best consigned to the dustbin of history?
The book certainly goes through kind of the experiments as well. Not everything is delicious, let's put it that way. I think for me, it really reminded me or made me think about the joys of preserving. So obviously then they kind of had to, right? But actually you can make these gorgeous flavours. One thing is just people making more of their own marmalades on old jams, but also things like just experimenting more with making brines and preserving vegetables as well. I mean, I think there's probably a percentage of people who do make jam every now and then, but what about bringing back some brines, some salted pickles and things like that? You know, have fun with it, I suppose.
And there's definitely a sense in your book of preventing food waste being about utilising every part of a foodstuff, whether that is, for example, an animal that you kill for meat or a vegetable. Are there any examples that stand out to you of things that we're perhaps a bit more squeamish about today that were ways of using all of a foodstuff in the past?
I think that's another thing that we've kind of become a bit, squeamish or distanced from the fact that if you eat meat, it's an animal, and that animal has all of the bits that an animal has, not just plain breast meat, for example, with chickens. So in the past, if you were lucky enough to have your pig, it would be a big ritual event to slaughter the pig in the autumn, and you would have fried up intestines and things to make something to eat there and then, and then you would have made salted meat, some which were more hard-wearing, some which you could eat sooner. And even things like preserving the bones, you know, you preserve them in a brine and then you can have that to add flavour to your food later on.
Are there any kind of vegetable equivalents? For example, did people use like what we would, you know, throw in the food waste bin today, like potato peels and stuff like that?
Oh, yes, definitely. I think if we look at World War II, that was an era in which the potato really came into its own, and you could maybe think of like creative ways of using potato because it was something that was so easy to grow and that actually was more calorific or nutritious for a larger number of people compared with the same amount of land being used to grow wheat. So the British government's Ministry of Food recommending that you use all of the potato to make potato bread, for example, or if you had a bit of sugar, you could make it into potato scones. And of course, things like any crumbs that you had left over from bread would have gone into making, was a lovely recipe that I have in the book that I've made, which is called crumb fudge from the World War II. And you use up the kind of stale bits of bread with your like butter and sugar rations and a bit of cocoa powder. And it's a bit like Rice Krispie cakes, like chocolate Rice Krispie cakes.
Ooh, that sounds delicious.
Yeah, it's really nice actually. So just having that kind of attitude to using up the whole of the vegetable or the food, if you had any scrapings from potatoes, you would have used that in a soup. Or, you know, worst case, then you start giving it to your animals. So potato peels to the chickens or to your pig or something like that.
Another era that you look at in the book is the Victorian era. And I thought that this might be a good way to talk about some of the historic jobs that have existed in the food waste industry, if we're to call it that. Can you give us some examples?
Yes. So in the Victorian era, I kind of traced this sort of street economy, I suppose, of leftovers and food waste. And you get people who seek out, they're called specs, which are the discarded bits of fruit, what we might call wonky fruit or veg today, I suppose. And they sell that on, you know, something that's been a little bit damaged or maybe overripe, maybe with little holes from insects. They would have sought that out and then sold that on to the poor for a very cheap price. Slum dwellers as well were seeking out crumbs, literally crumbs, old bread left over from bakeries. And then you had people who went door to door at households or taverns, cookshops, that sort of thing. They're called hogswash buyers, so seeking any sort of remains from meals, whether that be solids or liquids, and that then went to feed pigs, which is obviously an industry, a lucrative industry. You had people who would even sift through dust yards, so their version of landfills, and seek out, honestly, little scraps, a bit of leftover meat, a little bit of leftover vegetables, and then sell that on to make manure or animal feed. Any old rags could also go to make manure, bits of fat for soap boilers or glue makers. And then there were these things called rag and bottle shops, which were like these kind of junkyards full of rags, waste paper, old saucepans, bones, kitchen grease, old dusty bottles. So there was this sort of economy on the street of these poorer people selling the leftovers from food for very small amounts of money. But yeah, nothing would have been wasted. If they could, they would get some value out of the scraps.
It's a fascinating world because on the one hand, it feels sad, this idea of people, you know, rummaging through landfill sites, essentially, to get any scrap of something they could sell. But on the other side, it's kind of amazing that so much of this stuff was reused. They were masters of recycling, really, weren't they?
Yeah, and I think that's something that is maybe unexpected in the book. I think people might assume it's going to be, yeah, you look back on the past and it's just about finding these ways of dealing with our current food waste crisis. But actually, we do tend to look back on the past with rose-tinted glasses. We think of kind of people living in harmony with the land and living in kind of these smaller circular economies of food, which is, you know, true to a degree. And like I say, there's many ways in which we can learn from them. But this is one way, I think, where we don't want to learn. We don't want to have that level of inequality, right? When people are eating literally crumbs or seeking out kitchen grease so that they can have the drippings from a roast that they can get a tiny bit of nutrition from. We don't want that, right? So I think the history is kind of more interesting on its own terms, as well as educating us and making us think about the present.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the story of food waste, what have been some of the key inventions that have helped ordinary people tackle food waste in their homes?
The big ones, really, in terms of preservation are, firstly, the tin can. So this was invented in the very early 19th century, actually as part of a competition by the French government who were seeking new ways of preserving food to feed the army and the navy. So before this, people who were travelling, sailors, colonists, armies, navies, they would have relied on, let's just say, disgusting food, right? So hard tack, which is literally, it's essentially just flour and water, little biscuits, not what we think of as a biscuit today. So just no flavour, completely hard. They avoided any flavour, essentially, so that it wouldn't go off, go to waste when they were travelling. And then very, very heavily salted meat. We've got hundreds of accounts, thousands of accounts probably, of people complaining that they've had to eat this just hideously salty meat to survive when they travel. So the tin can is actually invented in that context, is a way of being able to travel further without having to change the taste of food. And that in a tin can, it can last, you know, much longer as well than these other more primitive ways of preserving food. So that's a big one. It takes a while to get accepted into households. unsurprisingly, because there are lots of stories of it going off on these voyages. And, you know, these poor sailors the other side of the world opening these tin cans and finding it to be absolutely putrid. So that it has a bad reputation, but eventually, kind of in the late Victorian era, the tin cans do become part of people's pantries, store cupboards, as they are today. The other one, of course, is artificial refrigeration. Again, this is really first used to move food across the world. In the 1870s, it's when it really takes off. There's all these experiments in trying to move fresh meat without, again, all those additives of salt or sugar, whatever, whatever, across the world. And again, there are lots of ill-fated voyages, but eventually by 1900, it means that almost half of the lamb and mutton that's eaten in Britain comes all the way from New Zealand, Australia. And of course, that's starting to get into the kind of globalized world of food that we are so reliant on today, meaning that food can be imported cheaper than being grown at home. And again, without those additional flavors to preserve it. Again, it takes a much longer time for that to end up in the household. Actually, not really until the 1970s is it common for people to have their own fridges in the UK, a bit earlier in the US. Freezers take into the 1980s, but of course that completely revolutionizes people's everyday lives, as well as how they eat.
And it's a surprisingly recent history. Before we kind of touch on the post-war era, I wonder if we could just return to World War II for a minute. How did rationing in particular make people rethink food waste? We hear about all these kind of amazing tales of home front rationing, but was that new or were they drawing on a longer tradition?
Well, actually, before the First World War and again kind of into war, people are wasting food. Because in the late Victorian era, you start getting perhaps what you can term the sort of throwaway society because of new inventions. So things like we were saying, the tin can, you have ice boxes, which aren't artificial refrigeration, but, you know, people can store food in these little cabinets which have ice, and so they can keep things a bit longer. And you've got the invention of branded products. So more and more people are turning to brands, packaged food, rather than making it at home. So one example is Heinz tomato ketchup, which of course is American. That's arriving at the end of the Victorian era in people's households, whereas before that would have been something that you made at home. And actually, most commonly, it was mushroom ketchup rather than tomato ketchup. That's another story. Anyway, so you do start getting the beginnings of this sort of quote-unquote throwaway society. So when World War One and then World War Two hits, it is really suddenly a national crisis, and the government gets involved in both cases to manage people's food waste like never before. This is an issue of national survival. In World War Two, rationing is introduced in January 1940, and almost essentially all foods end up being rationed. But they also teach people through the publication of cookbooks and other kind of leaflets how to reuse their leftovers. We've mentioned the potato before, but many other kind of thrifty dishes, like making sure you use your stale crust to coat foods for frying, or again, potatoes into pancakes and pastries and so on. But also to save food waste, actually to go into the war effort more directly. So kind of like in the Victorian era, when bits like fat go into industries like the soap industry and so on. In World War II, fat goes to make fertilizers, it goes to make explosives even. So there's a huge drive to collect any leftovers, either to go to this war effort or to feed pigs, which again end up as meat, which is very much wanted.
And do we have any sense of how successful these government initiatives to prevent food waste were?
Yes, they're incredibly effective. Again, because, you know, it's a matter of survival. People kind of, they had to. But there's a lovely, I'm not sure if I can remember it off the top of my head, but there's a lovely sort of poem of the era, which is something like, because of the food scraps, the pigs got saved. Because of the pigs, the nation got saved, or something like that. And it ends up ultimately saying housewives who collected food scraps ended up saving the nation. And there is a kind of drive to see them as just as valuable as people fighting in combat because they kept people at home fed.
Moving into the post-war era, I think we often think of this as the era of mass consumerism, when worrying about waste went out of the window. But is that true, or were some people still, you know, banging the drum of food waste prevention?
The post-war era is fascinating because everything seems to happen very quickly. So by the mid-1970s, food waste has doubled compared to pre-war levels. You've got the introduction of fridges and freezers. You've got supermarkets and American fast food chains come into the UK as well very quickly in the 1960s. And as a result, yeah, this is becoming a wasteful society. But at the same time, people, you've got this huge kind of countercultural movement that is trying to identify and fight those problems that it sees with this massive expansion of the kind of modern globalized food system. So you get one kind of key moment is the publication of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring in 1962 in America, which is an American book, which exposes the problem with pesticides use, especially DDT, and it kind of kickstarts this new environmentalist campaign against the use of pesticide fertilizers, but also the rise of plastic packaging and the use of landfill, which suddenly balloons as well in the post-war era. It's crazy to think how recent this is. You know, in 1996, the UK was still sending 90% of its waste to landfill. Only 5% was being recycled. So it's still very, very modern, these problems. But the other thing that happens in the post-war era is people fighting against food waste from that kind of moral divide between rich and poor angle. So you get punks of some people, anarchists who start skip diving or dumpster diving, depending on where you live, and rescuing food and then redistributing it to people who are in need. And in the US in particular, there's a big movement, Food Not Bombs, which starts doing that. And that sort of spreads to the UK slowly.
I think that leads me on nicely to my final question, which is just what you think we can learn from looking at this history and how it makes you reflect on the future of food waste.
Yes. Well, as I say, I think obviously food waste is such an important contemporary issue. The food we waste today in the UK alone is the equivalent in CO2 of 4.6 million return flights from London to Perth. So it is such a huge part of the modern battle against climate change. And I think there's so much we can learn from the past about how to reduce our food waste, how to use up leftovers, how to maybe think about preserving food at home and kind of, yeah, fall back in love with those sort of traditional methods. But most importantly, I think we can learn the value of food a bit more. For me, writing this history, learning about this history, it really struck me how much we've distanced ourselves from our food, from the processes of nurturing, growing, preserving, cooking our food. And I think if we can kind of reconnect to that, that we might realize how valuable it is, you know, rather than thinking of it as something that's created in these faraway countries and that is just readily available to us. Actually, it's a valuable and finite resource. If we can connect to that, maybe we'll end up wasting less food, I think. And of course, as we mentioned before, it's not just an environmentalist issue, but it is an issue about plenty and want, poor and rich. And as I say, food waste continues to reflect that divide. So I think reflecting on the history, those themes kind of echo through history and can teach us about what are our values today? Why are we wasting food? And what does that tell us about who we value and what we value?
That was Eleanor Barnett speaking to me, Ellie Cawthorn. Eleanor's book is Leftovers, A History of Food Waste and Preservation. Eleanor has also written a host of historical recipes for us, from Victorian smoking bishop punch to Georgian 12th cake, You can find those now on our website, historyextra.com. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer-Arden. Mm-hmm.